Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. Those on Teams, you might want to mute, and then you can unmute when it's time to speak. I'm calling the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order just in time to welcome Senator Wilson, and also we have Senator Myers with us, and online on Teams we have Senator L.V. Gray Jackson. So welcome to you. Today is Thursday, May 27th. Let the record reflect the time is 1:31 p.m. I'd like to remind everyone in the room, including those of us at the table here, to silence or turn off our cell phones. And thank you to those assisting us today. We really appreciate your coming in. We know that committees aren't all up and running, and so you had to work today on this in a way that you might not have had to otherwise. So today we have called several presenters to explore the governor's proposal that is part of this special session, which includes a 50-50 split of the POMV draw as part of an overall fiscal plan. And there's been a lot of discussion about the PFD split itself, but not in the context of the overall plan. And so I thought that was important for us to understand that as a community and regional affairs committee, because these things have impact at the ground level. They have impact on our communities, on Alaskans, and I thought helping Alaskans know what is being proposed and for us to think about that, what that might mean as far as in the communities, was important. So we have five presenters, and I'm going to go through those five quickly, and then we'll start with our first. First, we'll have Commissioner Lucinda Mahoney with Department of Revenue give us an overview of the governor's fiscal plan regarding the budget, revenues, reserves. And following that presentation and committee questions, we'll have Office of Management and Budget Director Neil Steininger give us, based on that proposal, what those budget implications might be over the years, as far as, again, how we might feel that on the ground level, what that might mean in our communities to Alaskans, what that might look like as far as line items in the budget, how they might change, or and what might happen with services, school funding, things like that, because I think there's a sense that there would need to be draconian measures to make this happen. And so that's, we want to find out, is that true? Is that not true? Then next we will hear from Dr. Mohsin Ghatabi on the economic impacts of when you have a fiscal plan to close a gap like we have, what the various fiscal options are, what are the ramifications and economic impacts of the different levers that you can choose. And then finally, if we were to settle on a plan, what are the implications and ramifications of having certainty versus not having certainty in our state and on a macro level. Then we'll zone in on a micro level to kind of look at what might happen in communities in regard to economic development as far as for small businesses and things. And we've invited Christy Bell from the Business Enterprise Institute and Tim Dillon from the Kenai Peninsula Economic District. So that's kind of the overview. We're going to have let the commissioner begin, and then we'll drill down. We'll welcome questions along the way as long as we kind of stay on track. We have allotted 2 hours for this meeting as opposed to the typical 90-minute committee meeting, just because it's a lot of meat here that we need to digest. So are there any comments or questions from committee members? And Senator Gray Jackson, you can just unmute whenever and pipe in. You could also, if you want to, I'm just trying to think, you could also try texting me, and I might see if it pops up, or texting my committee aide. So, Senator Gray Jackson, do you have any comments before we begin? Senator Gray Jackson, can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
There we go. Okay, good.
Do you have any questions or comments before we begin?
No.
Okay, thank you. So with that, at our table, we welcome Commissioner Mahoney, please begin your presentation after you put yourself on the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Hughes and members of the committee. My name is Lucinda Mahoney, and I am the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. My goal this afternoon is to provide you with information relating to the governor's comprehensive fiscal plan that he has submitted to the legislature in the form of some constitutional amendments.
I'm going to interrupt because I'm not sure if our microphones are working. I'm wondering if people are hearing, and you maybe need to pull that closer. Is the audio working?
It's on for my part, but the team's mic, I'm not sure if they can hear.
Test, is that better?
I can hear that over the speaker.
Yeah, bring it in just a little closer, please.
How about that? Better?
Get it even closer.
Closer?
Yeah, eat your microphone.
All right, how's that?
Okay. That's better.
All right. So as I was saying, our goal is to provide you with the details associated with the governor's comprehensive fiscal plan. In summary, the governor has proposed a structured, disciplined fiscal plan that provides a framework that leads us to fiscal certainty, which I think is really important for our state. We don't believe that at this point it requires a broad-based tax. We estimate that with a $3 billion transfer from the ERA into the CBR, that is then supplemented by additional new revenues as well as reductions in 23 and 24, that we've achieved a framework to fiscal sustainability into the future. Specifically, the components of the fiscal plan are first to protect the permanent fund by creating an endowment.
I'm going to call Nadies real quick. And we're back on the record. I apologize for that interruption. We wanted to make sure that those watching from home can see the slides up on the screen. But I also want to mention to those listening or watching from home, these slides are also available under Community Regional Affairs, that committee for today's date under documents. So continue, Commissioner.
Yes, I'll just go ahead and start from the beginning on this slide for those at home. So the governor's goal is to establish a structured discipline plan that constitutionalizes an endowment, more modern permanent fund into the Constitution, as well as enshrines the permanent fund dividend into the Constitution. And this is to protect it and to ensure that it will be available for generations into the future. This structural fix provides a framework for a sustainable fiscal plan. Other key components is to establish a consistent permanent fund dividend for Alaskans. Lately, the dividend has varied in terms of the value over the years, and the goal is to establish some consistency with the dividend so that Alaskans have some certainty around what their dividend will be, and so government can plan for a sustainable amount of government services that are more certain. In order to enable this plan to be successful, we have to establish a strong reserve foundation, and we are recommending at least $1 billion in our CBR. And I will go into the details of that here shortly. But also, the combination of all of these need to result in a sustainable, balanced budget for the future. We are here in the first special session that was called by the governor, and his goals for this session are to start working on these structural fixes and to establish what I discussed on the earlier slide. Also, the governor has called a second special session, and the objective of this session is to discuss with the legislature new revenue measures as well as potential reductions to spending to achieve an overall balanced budget. Now I'm going to focus on converting and modernizing the permanent fund to an endowment structure. An endowment structure, as I mentioned earlier, is a more modern way to manage our permanent fund investment. It is a nationally, internationally accepted best practice. And the way that this would work is that we would determine the distributions from the permanent fund would be based on a 5% draw. And the governor's proposal is to spend 50% of that draw on government services going forward, and to then spend 50% of it on dividends. And his objective is to get this into the Constitution so that it creates some certainty for everyone. This methodology also stabilizes the revenues in the PFD based on the smooth five-year average of the permanent fund program. Another component of the plan is to protect the Power Cost Equalization Fund, which is currently at $1.1 billion, by depositing this into the permanent fund program. What this does is also protect power cost equalization for future generations to ensure that they get the electricity services and needs that they require. What you see here on this next slide.
Let me pause there for a moment. Senator Wilson has a question.
Go back to the previous slide. Just on the question on the power cost equalization, depositing that endowment, is that going to be kept in a separate account for PCE, so that draw would only work off of PCE, or would that just be congregate within the total fund of the corpus of the permanent fund?
It would be deposited into the corpus of the permanent fund, and at this time there is not a plan to do separate accounting for it.
Okay. And
go ahead, follow up.
Then that just becomes, as it is now, just a subject to appropriation to the legislature if they decide to fund it or not to fund it.
The way that the amendment was written is that the approximate $30 to $40 million annual contribution that is provided in regard to meeting the needs of these rural communities would be the first call, if you will, out of the 50% component for government services.
Go ahead. And the other question would be on stabilizes both revenues. Even in a five-year rolling average in the market, we don't really have that stabilization control, so it would just be more of just more predictability. But there's no guarantee that next year or following years we could have a 08 year in the market that could sort of destabilize our growth and our revenues over a five-year average.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilson, that is a good point. And there is a recognition that we could potentially have market disruptions. However, with the five-year smoothing, we believe that there would be plenty of time for us to react should it be a sustained market correction. But the overall averaging and smoothing does create more consistency and certainty for the near future.
And thank you for that. I have a couple of questions too. Can you flip back on just so the screen's consistent with our conversation? Thank you. One of the reasons why it's important for us to put this out on the table during the special session is to help Alaskans understand what is being proposed. And there is listening to some of the public testimony in House Judiciary and things. We need to all come along and understand this together. And one of the things that there was a lot of frustration when SB 26, the POMV statute, was first passed, and it was simultaneously during the time when the statutory formula for the PFD was not being followed. So there was this kind of animosity against the POMV just because of what was happening alongside it. And yet the POMV itself is just a way to calculate how much is going to be drawn. There's nothing inherently evil in that. It's a calculation. But one of the things that has helped me grapple with it, and I would just like you to comment, is to understand during the first 35 years or so, with the old statutory draw, you know, we have the traditional statutory formula for calculating the PFD, but there was also a draw calculation in that. And that the only reason why, well, the reason why the fund grew so nicely is because for those first 30 plus years, even though the government could have used half of that draw, the government didn't. It stayed in the fund. However, if we were to go stick with that statutory draw calculation, and the government is using it now because oil production is not what it used to be, et cetera, we would actually be exceeding what's considered an amount to allow growth, the 5%. I don't know what that would be. This year, maybe it would be like 4.5, 4.6 or something. I'm not exactly sure what it would be. Do you happen to know what the percentage of the statutory calculated draw that's not the SB 26, not that part of the statute, but based on the PFD formula, what that draw would be as far as a percentage? My understanding is there's some years it could go up to like 7 or 8%. And if your average growth is 6.25, there could be years where you're actually pulling out more than you would be earning. Can you just comment on that?
Yeah, through the chair. I don't have the historical perspective, but I'd like to ask Mike Barnhill to come join me, if that's okay, because he does, please. And he can provide some insights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. Let me make sure I understand your question. I think what you're asking is what percentage of the POMV draw could potentially be consumed by the statutory formula of the PFD.
That's not my question. My question is, let's just pretend for a moment SB 26 never passed. When you look at how to calculate the statutory traditional PFD, it allowed for half of that to go to the PFD and the other half for the government. That total draw would be a lot bigger than 5%. That's a larger draw. And it worked for years because the government portion was being left in the fund. But now, all of a sudden, if we were every year taking out that bigger draw, we would have a problem some years because the growth of the fund might be less, you know, than that draw amount. In other words, you could be spending more than you're earning, in a way.
Let me try again. So setting aside the percent of market value, I think what you're asking for is what percentage of the market value of the fund is the statutory net income formula. Is that basically it?
What, the draw?
Yeah, and Madam Chair, it's changed, and I have a spreadsheet that I can provide the committee. It varies dramatically year over year. And perhaps it helped the committee to understand why. The statutory net income formula depends on what the definition of net income includes: cash in the form of dividends from stocks, coupons from fixed income, rents from real estate, and then net realized gains from changes in the portfolio. So when the managers of the permanent fund corporation change managers, for instance, or they liquidate an investment, it can potentially generate net realized gains. Those decisions get made based on internal investment considerations. In some years, we're realizing considerable amount of realized gains through those management and portfolio changes, and other years we're not. And so there's a fair amount of volatility in those investment decisions. So there isn't really consistency over time with respect to the percentage of statutory net income vis-a-vis the total value of the portfolio. But I, like I said, I have a spreadsheet. I'd be happy to provide it to the committee.
Let me ask this way, and I understand what you're saying. The statutory PFD would take, is it $2.2 billion, the traditional formula this year?
I believe it's closer to 2.3.
2.3. Okay, so then that would tell you if you didn't have, if SB 26 wouldn't have passed, that would allow 2.6 for government. So, 2.3.
The 2.3 is the 50-50. It's closer to 3.
Okay, then whatever it is, yeah, let's say for a moment that it's 3. If it's $3 billion, then, and if you're allowing the same amount for government, that would then be a $6 billion draw, which would be really far breaking this 5%. You would be taking out quite a bit more. My point is that we need a smaller draw because there is some years where now that the government's not leaving its portion in the fund like it was for 30-plus years, it's going to use its portion. You want to make sure that you're not taking out more than you might average in earning over time. And if the average earning over time, I believe, is 6.25 or 6.5, and you were taking out draws in some years, like you said, it'd be volatile, but in a year, given year, it could be 7.5% or something, or 8%. And that this 5% basically will better ensure the growth of the fund. Would you agree with that statement?
Madam Chair, I would. And all of the numbers that I've been putting before the committee are incorrect, and it would probably be a bit better if we just rely on the spreadsheet that I will provide you later as opposed to my recollection of what the numbers are. But your point is a fair one.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. I think it's important for the – I think what the public is – what I'm hearing is the public's very concerned about the fairness issue and as far as who gets what, you know, how much for government, how much for the people's PFD, and just trying to explain why we're kind of coming up with a draw calculation that's different. That's but really the split that is in the proposal is actually similar. It's the same split that was used for those 30-plus years. It's just a different draw size, really, is the way I see it. And of course, you're proposing constitutionalizing it as well. But it's the size of the draw that's now different than it was for the 30-plus years. But how much is available for government versus how much is available for the PFD would be the same since the PFD program began. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I'm reluctant to say that the sizes have changed. For the past 30 years, it's been very volatile vis-a-vis the total value of the fund because it's a different methodology. Mm-hmm. In terms of the split, the statutory net income formula is a 50-50 split mm-hmm. of the earnings, the five-year average of the earnings, the statutory net income. And what the governor is proposing here is a 50-50 split of 5% of the five-year average of the market draw. So they're both 50-50,
right,
but of different things.
Right, exactly, different things, exactly. Okay, so I also had a question regarding the PCE, just wondering the asset allocation and how the current PCE is invested. Is it potential that it will earn more by putting it in with permanent fund, or is it invested pretty similarly as far as what it's earning compared to the permanent fund?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Hughes. The PCE is invested with moderate risk. And so it does invest in public equities and, you know, it has a similar allocation to the perm fund. However, it does not invest in private equities at the same level as the perm fund does. And when you look at the asset allocation and the higher performing assets in the perm fund, the private equities are right now the area that is outperforming the most. So I do believe it is fair to say that by moving the PCE into the PERM fund, if it continues to perform at the same level that it is today, the PCE would generate higher earnings.
Okay, that's helpful, I think, for the public to know and for legislators to know as well. And you may have to get back to us on this, but I've been told, and I don't have anything to present to show it, that when the PCE was first set up, it was an investment of about $300 million, and now it's about $1.1 billion, as you know. But during that time, since it was set up, that about $12 billion was spent on power infrastructure on the rail belt. Does that ring true? Do you have any information? Because I think that's really important for folks to understand that difference and why it maybe does make sense to provide something for the rural areas, having lived in Huna, Bethel, and Fort Yukon, and having paid some pretty big power bills. It is it's something you can understand why the rural areas are concerned about it. So do you have any knowledge as far as the history of what the fund was started and then what was spent, and would that be something you could get to the committee later if you don't have it?
Madam Chair, I don't have that at my fingertips, and we will bring it back to you.
Okay, great. I think that is important, and it's good to know that it would grow a little faster too. Any other questions before we move on? Okay, we are on slide 5 then.
So this next slide provides a graphical depiction of the historical dividend payments. And the right quirky dots, or the red quirky dots on the slide, identifies from 1982 up through 2022 or 2021 what has been paid out for dividends. The dark line that moves up towards the right, the dark green line, represents the statutory payments that would have been paid. The dotted line that is in the middle between the orange line and the green line represents what a 50-50 dividend would look like. And so as you can see on these slides, on this slide here, it represents about a halfway point, if you will, between what has been paid historically over the last 6 years versus what a statutory dividend would have been. So there's been a lot of discussion in our communities and in the legislature about the dividend, the size of the dividend, and what we hear is there can be some public mistrust in regard to how the decisions are made regarding the dividend. Some believe that we're spending too much money on government, not enough money on the dividend. And here in the Capitol, it can create political impasse. And so it's so important. The governor believes it's really important for us to land on a methodology and establish a rules-based approach, something that's more reliable, consistent, and takes the conversation off the table, if you will, in regard to the dividend and how it's calculated and the consistency of it. And as we said, his proposal is to constitutionalize it and for it to be 50% for government services and 50% for the dividend. This next graphical table provides an estimate of what the forecasted dividend would be, assuming a 6.25% interest rate. And just for the record, the 6.25% interest rate is a capital market estimated growth provided by Callan and Associates, who is a consultant to both the PERM Fund organization as well as to the ARM board. But as you can see on the slide, the dividend at a 50-50 level for 2022 would be $2,354. And using the investment methodology, by year 2052, it would be $4,400.
Do you happen to know by 2052 that $4,476, what that would be in today's dollars? In other words, I'm just wondering if I remember looking up when I was on the PFD working group, and there was a $1,000 PFD paid in I believe it was 1982. And that was equivalent to about $3,000 in today's dollars. So I'm just wondering, looking at how inflation might play in, that $4,476, you happen to know what that is in today's dollars?
Chair Hughes, yes. We did run that analysis, and the number is just under $2,400, adjusting for inflation. Oh. So it's pretty constant.
Okay. That's helpful to know. Thank you. Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Do you know what the earnings growth was for the past 30 years of the permanent fund? Just off of the interest, not off of the additional payments that the legislature has made for those additional inflation-proofing?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, what I do know is over the last 45 years, the permanent fund has grown an average of 8.6%. We have not, however, calculated what that would be if we would remove the additional inflation adjustment deposits that were made into the corpus. We could determine that for you.
Thank you.
This next slide is intended to create a discussion about the importance of the consistency of the dividend program. And our first point is that we believe Alaskans, the governor believes Alaskans deserve certainty around what the check for them will be. But also the state needs certainty in terms of determining how much will the dividend cost and how much do we need to plan for it? What type of revenue level do we need to address in order to pay a consistent dividend? And absent this certainty, it's extremely difficult for us to first ever achieve a balanced budget, but it also may result in us setting up tax programs that overtax our citizens. And we want to establish fiscal sustainability in a method that taxes our population the least amount. The 50% POMV amount is an equitable distribution of this natural resource wealth to its citizens and to the government. And this is strongly supported and believed by the governor. And this is the dividend allows a discussion for us to really discuss, as I mentioned earlier, what the revenue target is. And hopefully establishing a consistent dividend would redirect the legislative conversation, many of our community conversations, more about economic growth, how can we increase jobs in our state, versus constantly talking about deficits and what is the dividend amount.
I'd like to add to that last point, because in addition to spending all our time debating the PFD, it's also push other items of importance off the table as far as our workload and focus. And I would mention the fact that sadly we have the highest rate of crime, sexual crime, in our state. Right now we have some very serious academic achievement gaps, and some of these things, other issues outside of economic development, jobs, which is very important for the health and well-being of Alaskans and communities, some of these other issues aren't getting addressed like they should be. And if this matter were settled, I think we could be doing some other great things for our state besides growing our economy. We could be taking care of some serious needs in other policy areas. So I just want to make that point, because that's been frustrating for me. Some of these other big issues are getting pushed aside, and it's time we address this, I believe, so that we can take care of some other important matters. So just adding to that last bullet.
So now we're going to get into some of the details of the program that comprise the fiscal plan. And our The governor's goal is to use one of our strongest assets, which is the permanent fund. You know, as many of us know, it is achieving right now incredible returns in excess of 25%. And with $1 billion bridge funding to the CBR, we have forecasted that we believe we can manage our fiscal gap down to zero beginning in years 2024-25. With a strong reserve balance of $1 billion. And what the $3 billion does is it provides for time for the legislature and the governor to work together to identify new revenue measures as well as potential reductions that we can get into statute and then provide the time for the administration to get the tools in place to actually implement the tax and then be able to collect the tax or the new revenue measure or implement whatever expenditure reduction, depending on what is concluded. But it is, some folks may be wondering and be thinking about, is a $3 billion draw appropriate? And is that something that we really should be doing? But we have noted that there are other endowments throughout the United States that are actually overdrawing their endowment. And one notable example is Harvard, you know, the prestigious endowment that is so highly talked about in the press. But they are going to increase their withdrawal from 5% to 7.5% as a result of phenomenal market returns. But going back to our plan, we believe that this plan that we've presented would avoid a broad-based tax. We believe that $300 million is an achievable new revenue number or reduction to the budget that can result in smaller components of new revenue measures that could fill the gap. Additionally, by constitutionalizing the 5% and creating an endowment, it does protect this type of an overdraw situation from happening in the future. And the constitutionalizing of it, in fact, would prevent it from happening in the future.
Do you know if you were to add the, well, if you did it over a couple of years, let's say $1.5 billion additional to the POMV draw, what that percentage becomes? Is that 7.5? Would that be a 7.5% draw this year and a 7.5% draw next year? Is that what basically the proposal is with the $3 billion?
The $3 billion draw would result in just above a 7.5% total. I think it's 7.8% total draw. However, I want to point out that even though the request for the 2022 budget amendment is for a $3 billion draw effective at the end of 2022, we would work with the PERM Fund organization such that we would actually structure the transfers based on when the funds are needed, such that we would keep that money, the $3 billion, in the PERM fund for as long as possible to maximize the income return to the fund.
Thank you. Because we do have a statute that has the 5% line in there, and we've heard a lot of debate as far as the appropriation power based on the Constitution, would the administration be opposed as a way that we could follow the law to present a bill that would have a temporary adjustment to that, in other words, move it for 2 years to 7.7 rather than the 5%? Is that something so that statutorily we'd be following the statute instead of ignoring it? Would the administration be open to having a statutory language for a couple of years with that adjusted amount of a draw?
Yeah, Senator Hughes, I think we would need to take that back and discuss that with the governor.
Okay. I think I know for some folks that that's important that we're following the law, so I would like to know that answer, please. When you get it. And Senator Wilson has a question.
Go ahead.
I don't want to cut you off if you're about to respond.
No.
Okay. My question was in terms of what measures, the combination of revenue measures and spending reductions, which ones are you referring to in this bullet, and why haven't we done that now? Or those proposals been talked upon with the legislature now, because we've seen what happened when we tried to do major reductions, and I'm not sure if you guys have an item of where these revenue measures will come from, where the spending reductions, but those should be, obviously, if you have those magic bullets, we would love to hear them now instead of waiting till in the future to go through so we can start saving these dollars now.
Well, through the chair, the Department of Revenue is currently working on 2 to 3 new revenue measures that we plan to roll out in the August timeframe. But the governor is really wanting to solicit, you know, ideas from the legislature and to create an environment where this is the sole focus, is to talk about new revenue measures as well as budget reductions.
Guess to follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
If this avoids a new broad-based tax, which is a revenue measure, I'm just a little lost of that. You know, I prefer to have, you know, this is a comprehensive plan, to have that whole plan before us now instead of waiting to the future for us to have something that may or may not be tangible. It's really hard for us to plan as the fiduciary responsible, you know, as the having the purse strings of the state and trying to do what's best and have that long-term outlook for the state of Alaska. We can't just go off of hopes and dreams, is what my constituents have told me. They want a plan. We've heard this several times before. You know, we've worked with administration. We've given ideas and tried to find, you know, ideas of spending reductions. I think that you'll hit some of those ideations later on in your presentation, scrolling ahead, but it's really hard to do that. And to get to my question here, my second question was constitutionalizing the 5% PMOV overdraw in the future. How do we know this is a good standard for a draw, and are there scenarios where 5% may be too less or too much?
Mr. Barnhill has studied endowments, and so I'm gonna have him address that.
Sure. Mike Barnhill, for the record, through the chair, Senator Wilson. There's been quite a bit of discussion around what is the appropriate percentage for distributing from an endowment. And, you know, for the past 30 years, 5% of average market value is really the standard. And for private foundations, some private foundations, that is the standard that is enshrined in the Internal Revenue Code in order to maintain tax-exempt status. That doesn't apply to the permanent fund. And the notion with the 5% draw is if you can get nominal returns that are in excess of 5% plus whatever inflation is.
That, I could redirect my question, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Wilson.
We understand that 5% is the draw. How do we know that 5% doing a 50-50 will be the magic number for the state of Alaska to meet its fiduciary responsibilities to the citizens of Alaska? Have we stress tested this 5% draw with a 50-50, 50% going to the folks of Alaska, 50% going to government with this current plan? That's what I'm sort of asking. How do we know that 50% is a scenario where we may need more, or we may need less based on the current modeling of this current plan?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I apologize. I thought you were asking if 5% was the correct number. Short answer is it could be, but that's why we've added the language not more than 5% in case it becomes too much. But I think you're focusing on is 50% for government and 50% for PFDs the right number. And through the chair, Senator Wilson, you know, the answer to that is nobody has a crystal ball to forecast whether that's going to be enough to cover state expenses going forward in time. We've presented a scenario based on what's happening today, but 10 years from now, 20 years from now, circumstances will most certainly be different. But what this does is it settles the issue of the permanent fund and the permanent fund dividend. And in the future, if it turns out to be too much or too little, the legislature will have to make adjustments, either through spending, through taxes. When we settle the permanent fund issue and the permanent fund dividend issue, it enables the policymakers to focus more intently on the remaining issues, which are revenues and spending.
Senator Wilson?
This is a last question then. I thought this whole plan is to avoid taxes, but then you talk about taxes as in the future.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, yes, this is a scenario based on what we're experiencing today, but as I said, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, circumstances could be different. They could be better or worse. But when it comes to how we deal with those changes in circumstances, if this is passed, what we won't have to debate and discuss at length is how much do we pull from the permanent fund? How much do we allocate for permanent fund dividends? It narrows the questions, if you will.
Senator Wilson.
I just want to put out on the record, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. And so we do have that availability to be multi-directional in our policy making here in the legislature. So I just want to put that out there for the general public. We do focus on multiple items. That's why we have several different standing committees in different policy areas. And so I just want to put that out there that the PFD issue is an important issue. I care about this issue deeply, and I do want to settle this, and so that we can, as a whole, look at other options and take this one item off so we can look at another item and focus on. But it's not a singular issue that takes up the entire legislature, all 60 of us, our availability and time.
And I'll just say that your question, line of questioning to Mr. Barnhill, you might want, when we bring OMB Director Steininger up, because kind of looking at whether that 50% allocation, how that's going to work, at least based on what we know, like you said, things can change, but kind of that same line of questioning might be good for him as far as the budget implications. Did you have anything else? And were you finished with this page? Because I have a question, but I want you to finish the page if you didn't.
I'm finished.
And this, strangely, this actually isn't on the page, but I wanted to go back just, and you don't need to flip the slides back, but the PCE, you mentioned that it would earn a little bit more because of how it would be invested, and that the amendment right now, which we do not have in this committee, we're discussing the whole plan and the concept, is that the funding for the program would get first draw on the government's half. But there's nothing in this proposal or in the amendment that would prevent the legislature at any given point in time in deciding perhaps to use some of that draw to change out the power infrastructure in the rural areas so they could get off diesel, for example, because there's a lot of disruptive technology out there right now, a lot of innovative things, a lot of things being piloted that are pretty promising, and especially for small communities, the potential to get them changed out. And there's nothing in this proposal that would present that some of that funding coming out as the first draw from the government's half being used to change out, for instance, infrastructure in some of our communities to get them off of diesel. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Mike Barnhill, that is correct.
Okay. And that's another question the public's had about that matter. And so we're really not constitutionalizing a subsidy per se. We're constitutionalizing the fund, and that there'd be a certain amount that would come out, but that funding could be used if it's related to power cost equalization, it wouldn't have to necessarily be a subsidy. Would you agree with that?
Through the chair, Madam Chair, what this proposal does is, back up, we have in the Constitution an anti-dedication clause which prohibits a statutory dedication of revenues for a particular purpose. What this does is it dedicates revenues, a revenue stream, to a particular purpose. And whether you characterize that as a subsidy or not, that's up to the chair, but this is a dedication of revenues for power cost equalization in the state.
In other words, we could decide how we're going to help equalize out those power costs across the state. We could just keep, here's additional funding to pay your higher electric bill because you're on diesel, or we could say, here, we're going to give you this money because we're going to set you up so you're not on diesel. So it all does the same thing. And my point is, putting this in, as I read it, as I've studied it, it doesn't tie our hands to being able to make some changes that would be good in the long run for more affordable energy in the rural areas. Did you have a comment, Senator Wilson?
I do. Being a constitutional question going to the people, we could thus change that and make this sort of a draw, make this a dedicated fund in the Constitution.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the way it's presented as drafted, it is a dedication of funds to a purpose. So it's a classic dedication, if you will.
Okay.
All right, moving on to slide 9. This is a graphical representation of the deficit that we currently face approaching in 2022. We have a $1.4 billion deficit. And what it reflects is that when we incorporate a $3 billion deposit into the CBR, it shows the glide path in terms of how that deficit is reduced going forward, and then how we establish a sustainable budget that's balanced beginning in the 2027 timeframe. And the reason that this can happen is because of the growth of the POMV. So as you can see on the slide, during the timeframe that we're looking at here, it increases approximately $1 billion based on our forecast. And it significantly helps us close our gap. This next graphical representation identifies the point in time where we need to have new revenue measures or reduced budget in place in order for us to achieve a $1 billion minimum CBR balance. The dotted line, the red dotted line, is the minimum balance that we are recommending. And so you can see based on the circle that this is the point in time where we would need to have these new revenue measures or additional reductions in place. But what's really important to discuss or to think about in regard to this slide is the $1 billion minimum needed in reserves. In the past, in regard to the CBR, we've talked about a lower number. But we are proposing that this number be more than doubled and that it be available to provide liquidity for any type of near-term needs. This next graphical representation provides a similar picture, but it incorporates the additional $150 million new revenue measures in 24, and then again new revenue measures in 25 or reductions. And so what you can see here is that in regard to our reserves, you know, we flatten out in 2026, but yet still we're above the $1 billion mark. And then we gradually increase through the time frame. And that is largely due to the POMV revenues increasing, but also there are budgetary impacts that start falling off. For example, our tax certificate debt is planned to be paid off in 2027. So Mr. Steininger will be talking in more detail about the budget impact to our plan after we are complete. This next graph provides a visual of our budget versus our revenues, and each different color on the chart identifies the different type of revenue. But first of all, I'll just go through the green solid line represents our budget over time. And then the chart, each bar chart here, or bar line, represents our revenues by year. The blue component represents the traditional UGF revenue, and this is mostly comprised of our oil and gas taxes. The orange line represents the POMV revenue, and so you can see here graphically how we are expecting that revenue to grow based on the increased balance in the PERM fund. The yellowish area at the top represents how we would use the $3 billion transfer into the CBR over time. So you can see that it does diminish over time, such that by year 2027, it's no longer needed because it is being replaced by new revenue measures or reductions, which are reflected in the gray area of the chart.
We heard news, I believe it was yesterday, day before, about a large oil find off the Hall Road. It'll be a while before that might be woven into the blue part, the bottom part of that, of the bar. But can you speak to when and that might be incorporated? How long does that take? How many years would we know before that's actually, if it's a go and it's looking good based on what I've read, how might that impact those blue bars and when?
Madam Chair, I read the same article, and I immediately contacted our DNR Commissioner Feige and asked her that same question. She does not have information at this point regarding that potential fine that she can share. However, historically in the industry, it takes 5 to 7 years typically for a prospect to be developed to the point where it is producing oil, with five being extremely aggressive, more likely seven. So 7 years out may be a point in time where we would see that blue component of the revenues go up.
Thank you.
This next slide provides the detailed numbers associated with the fiscal plan. If you look down about three lines, you'll see a row that is titled New Revenues and Reductions. And in fiscal year 24, you can see the additional $150 million that ramps up to $300 million in fiscal year 2025. Looking down further on the page, you'll see a line item called budget surplus, which we are forecasting to begin in fiscal year 27. However, from my perspective, one of the more important lines is the CBR reserve ending balance, which you can see three quarters or halfway down the page. As I mentioned, our target was a minimum $1 billion, and it drops at the lowest point in our forecast to $1.2 billion in fiscal year 2026, and then continues to grow through the period to over $2 billion in fiscal year 2030. This also provides a numerical representation of the PFD amount and the 50% POMV that would be needed to fund that. And then lastly, we've identified our forecasted permanent fund investment balances at the end of each fiscal year.
Senator Wilson.
Commissioner, this line item here, the total general fund appropriations, has a pretty much a stagnant budget for the next, continuing the years that we've had a flat budget till now, would be about 13 years of having a sort of stagnant flat budget. How does that take into account inflation and the value of the dollar?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilson. I would like to defer the detailed components of that to Mr. Steininger, who is going to provide you an update on the details, and I think he'll be able to do it with a slide that'll provide you those answers, if that's okay.
That's perfectly fine.
Okay. All right, good. So we recognize that we are forecasting well into the future here, and we are making a lot of assumptions, and this is an estimate, and we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know if this is right, but we've done our best to develop what we believe is a conservative forecast. And our next slide provides just a recognition that there are some upside fiscal benefits that have not been incorporated into these numbers. And the first one relates to our retirement accounts for PERS and TERS. And as similar with the permanent fund, these retirement accounts have also had fabulous returns this year. And as a result of that, assuming it all holds through the end of June, we will have significant upside on that account, hopefully in the neighborhood of $5 billion. And what this will do in the future is it may reduce the state's contribution to these retirement accounts, and that may have a positive impact, if you will, on our forecast. Additionally, we want to point out that there are no ARP, federal stimulus funds, that have been incorporated in our numbers. So to the extent that those are moved by the legislature into the numbers, that will only improve our CBR balances. Also, the state regularly lapses funds. None of that has been incorporated into the numbers. Also, there are potential reductions in some of the programmatic formulas that may be experienced in the future. And particularly, I just want to point out that when we look at the Department of Labor population estimates, you know, currently we are experiencing a reduction in population. And so to the extent that that population number is incorporated in some of these programmatic formulas, that may reduce some of our expenditures. And then lastly, you know, we're coming off a fabulous market return environment. We've projected 6.25%. It could be that the returns are higher, fingers crossed. However, the areas that I'm most concerned about in terms of a plan like this is really the downside risk and being able to protect our funds and to be able to manage through some sort of liquidity crisis. So the areas that we are concerned about is, first of all, in regard to inflation. You know, as many of you know, the month of April, there was a 4% inflation increase, and we will likely see that in the next month or two. But we don't know how long this will last. I look to our Federal Reserve Chairman, Jerome Powell, who has commented on inflation. And he does characterize inflation that we are experiencing currently as transitory, recognizing that we do have a supply demand disruption, you know, as a result of the pandemic. The question is, you know, how long will this last? You know, how long will it take manufacturing to get back up to speed to meet demand from our consumers? Also, there is a downward risk of a market correction. You know, a lot of folks talk about when or if that will occur. Fortunately, the investment POMV smooths it over a period of 5 years. So should there be continued downward market returns, what that would do is it would give the legislature and the governor time to get together and establish different revenue measures than would have previously been established as we looked at the $300 million gap to fill. Also, there's a risk in terms of failure to realize downward pressure on our budgets. You know, the governor is leading his departments to continue to look for efficiencies and way to reduce costs. So some of that has been incorporated in our outlook. and Neil will talk about that, as I mentioned earlier, but there's a risk that that may not be implemented. So we're just being very transparent. And then lastly, but not leastly, is just oil price and volume volatility. You know, we saw what happened as a result of that last year with the pandemic, but we believe the $1 billion reserve can help, would help us manage liquidity through that and still enable us to get, if it was a continued downward oil price environment, it would enable us time to get together, the legislature and the governor, to discuss additional revenue measures.
Senator Wilson.
And this question may go to our OMB director at a future time and date here, talking about the state lapse, the $231 million in 2020. Is that more related to COVID, or are we really that bad as being the appropriators that we have an issue with our budgeting process for the past decades or so? And $67 million out of a $10, $13 billion budget that we passed, state all funds considered, is still within that region of good margin, having that plus or minus balance. And then the DSSS programs, you know, we're sort of stuck there without, we can't make any changes to that program federally until 2020, and that's probably going to be extended for another couple of years through our federal administration, unfortunately. So I'm just a little concerned about the potential reductions. So, and I understand the population downsize, but you know, that doesn't count the utilization of that program, and it's really about the utilization that matters more than sort of the population change for some of those programs that we're just sort of stuck with, unfortunately, for a foreseeable future until we can get some help with our federal delegation in changing some of those items.
Senator Wilson, you said until 2020, I think.
Until 2021.
Until?
Well, at least until December 31st of 2021.
Okay.
As current, but that is expected to be extended, is my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
So these next graphs provide some standard slides that I understand you are used to receiving from legislative finance. So we wanted to provide them as well in the same format. And the slide on the graph on the left compares the base POMV to the scenario that the governor is proposing in regard to the 50-50, $3 billion draw. We just be totally transparent. You know, we do recognize that in the future that the POMV will be smaller as a result of the draw. However, it is the governor's position that the short-term benefit in terms of establishing a plan and having structure and fiscal discipline going forward is beneficial.
Can you tell us in the starting there in 2025, it's kind of hard, the orange line's just a little bit less than the blue line. Are we talking a difference in $100 million? How much are we talking of the difference?
$50 million in 2025.
And that is that kind of go steady all the way up through 2030? Is about
The maximum amount would be $113 million in 2030.
That's the range. Okay, thank you.
The graph to the right identifies what we estimate the PERM fund ending balances to be through the time frame.
And again, the difference there, just looking at the year 2030, what is it about?
$2.4
billion. A difference,
yes.
$2.4 billion difference. Okay, thank you.
Would it be?
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. For these comparisons and with this model, is there a way that we can get this sort of as a 10-year look back in those couple of those different models and trends of what that would have looked like in the from, let's say, 9 to 2017 look back of if we had those markets, what would this look like, or what would this look like if we have from 2002 to 2009, sort of those type of years and look back of what those markets have those up and downs, and it'd be nice to see sort of more of the stress tested instead of a glide path.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, we are more than happy to model those scenarios for you. Just provide the assumptions, and we will do that. So this last slide just provides a summary of the governor's plan for fiscal and political stability. Just to reiterate, the plan is to constitutionally protect both the perm fund and the dividend, limit the draw to 5%, dedicate 50% of the draw to the dividends, and then to combine the principal and the ERA into one endowment account. Also, the plan is to constitutionally protect the PCE, to provide the bridge of $3 billion transfer from the ERA to the CBR, and then to work with the legislature to together discuss new revenues and reductions in August. Thank you.
Thank you. And as Senator Wilson mentioned earlier, and you indicated that August was when we were going to be talking about the that how you close that gap, are you going to be releasing information on what you're going to be proposing well in advance of August? I think it would be even helpful as part of this. A lot of folks are hesitant to move forward unless they kind of can see the big picture and how we can make this work. So will you be rolling something out sooner rather than later, and when might that be?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure of when that package will be ready and available, but I will certainly find out, and we can get back with you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much. We spent a little longer on this than we thought, so if Mr. Steininger can run up to the table, we'll keep moving along, and I'm going to ask you, Mr. Steininger, as concise as you can be, just so we can get back on track or other presenters. I felt like exploring pretty thoroughly what the proposal was important, but we did spend a little more time on it than I had planned.
For the record, Neil Sanger with the Office of Management and Budget. So what I have to speak to you about today is an updated version of the 10-year plan that OMB produces on an annual basis. So every year OMB produces a 10-year plan meant to illustrate the governor's policies as put forward in the December 15th budget, extended out for 10 years to show the impact of those plans on the long-term, you know, fiscal picture of the state. When you look at a 10-year plan, though, there's really kind of two time periods that you want to focus in on. Because, as was noted by the previous speakers, we don't really have a crystal ball to know what's going to actually happen in 10 years. So when you look at the out-year information, there's a lot more assumptions involved and a lot more just extension of sort of base escalators to spending or assumptions on revenue projections going forward. But when you look in kind of the more near term, that's kind of the more important picture in a 10-year plan, is those first couple of years and what the plan and what the budget objectives that we're putting forward, how they impact the state's fiscal picture. So when you look at this 10-year plan that's been updated for, you know, most recent oil price forecast from the spring revenue sources book, updated outlook on the POMV draws, as well as updates to all the different amendments that we've introduced to the governor's budget, you can really see that first 3 years, or the first several years, where that bridge fund concept in our SJR 6 proposal really starts to make sense and really lets us get to that longer term period where you can see that both the choices made in spending decisions as well as the better outlook in the POMV starts to close that gap over time. So in that short-term period, as we're getting there, we both have the bridge fund to bridge that gap, as well as some spending assumptions that we're making about policy decisions we have to make in the next several years. The second document that I provide the committee goes through a little bit about those assumptions. So I'll walk through those fairly quickly and just kind of open up for questions. So really looking at fiscal years 23 and 24, the main assumptions to pay attention to are the assumption of both a baseline capital budget at about $150 million extended by inflation over time, as well as $100 million per year in reductions for 2 years, totaling $200 million in total budget reductions. These reductions are net of some of those upside items that Commissioner Mahoney spoke of, as well as other things like anticipated cost increases from bargaining unit negotiations, as well as budget policy decisions that we make on an annual basis as we prepare the governor's annual budget for fiscal year 23 and 24. With that $100 million per year in reductions, we think that that is an achievable amount with, you know, policy considerations and discussions with agencies in terms of the programs that they manage, as well as other, you know, smaller changes as a result of, you know, better projections on our PERS payments, other policy items that we've discussed this year that will phase in over time. There's a couple of other things in those near years that are related to SJR 6. You have the PCE program that's being added in as a UGF expenditure. With the constitutionalization of the Power Cost Equalization Fund rolling into the permanent fund, we need to make room in the budget for that program that previously was funded through designated general funds. Additionally, there's room in these projections for things like community assistance that we previously have funded through designated general funds that now needs to find a home within our unrestricted general fund spending. When you look at future years, there are some questions about how do we escalate and account for things like inflation. We apply a 1.5% inflation rate, which really that's trying to acknowledge that inflation does have an impact on state budgets. But inflation isn't a perfect corollary for state spending. And so in those future years, we anticipate that policymakers will continue to put downward pressure on the budget and not allow it to grow at a rate greater than 1.5%. And when you look at prior years and you look at historical budgets, you can see that most of the time budget growth is really related to availability of revenue and not necessarily inflationary pressures. So we think it's reasonable to assume a fairly low inflation rate on state budgets.
Mr. Steininger, you mentioned $100 million in reductions for 2 years for a total of $200 million. Is that part of the $300 million that Commissioner Mahoney was speaking of over those 2 years period, and you're incorporating that thinking of that $300 million the governor hopes to have 200 of that be in reductions?
Chair Hughes, the model actually assumes the $200 million happens in those first 2 years prior to those $300 million, the $150 to $300 million that Commissioner Mahoney spoke of. So our baseline assumption is that we will, you know, make policy decisions for proposals that will result in $100 million a year in reductions to the agents or to the operating budget over the next 2 years prior to, you know, needing to address those revenue or possible additional policy discussions that would happen in that, you know, fiscal year 24 and on time period.
And can you speak to, because part of why we wanted to bring you in is so that the public and those in the various communities might know what that might feel like on the ground level. So when you're talking $100 million in each of the next 2 years, how might an Alaskan recognize and see that difference? Where are you proposing?
Senator Hughes, it's hard to give a specific about this. The budget process, as we put together these proposals, we work with agencies over the course of every year continuously on ways that we can reduce operating costs within agencies. And a lot of that, primary focuses are how can we reduce operating costs without reducing services. So a lot of what we try to do is look at, are there different ways to do things? One of the things that we're working on currently is looking at how the state actually occupies facilities. One thing that COVID showed us over the last year is that some state work doesn't necessarily require as much physical footprint in offices as we currently have. That was one thing discussed a lot over the summer leading up to the development of the fiscal year 22 budget. But we just didn't have the information yet at that point to know what our real footprint need is. We're getting a better handle on that as we have adapted to people, some people coming back into the office and seeing how we can have these, you know, different schedules people have with overlap and figuring out how we can consolidate some of that space and save the state money. So you'll see some of those types of, you know, modernization of the way the state does business type of items, you know, looking at some of these consolidation initiatives that, you know, some are just in their infancy, but really are going to, over time, we'll be able to find ways that we can save money. So a lot of it is about modernizing the way the state does business or changing the way that we're performing services in a way that hopefully to the end user, to the end constituent, is not visible. For some of those bigger things that really would impact communities, those are bigger policy discussions that aren't necessarily, you know, addressed through just a line item reduction in a budget, but are a wider policy discussion. So when you start talking about, I know there's a Medicaid was mentioned during the prior presentation. When you start talking about programs like that, they're much wider discussions than just a line or a, you know, an increment or a decrement in a state budget. You know, they really have to have robust policy conversations with stakeholders and with legislature. But over this time span, you know, there will need to be some of those types of discussions. But as we have those discussions and have concrete proposals, that, you know, really that impact on the constituent needs to be a part of that discussion.
Any questions, Senator Wilson?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Where to start? We'll start with the capital budget. Right now you have a baseline capital budget. That's just for the match. That doesn't address our deferred maintenance. It doesn't address the school deferred maintenance list as well.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the $150 million baseline capital budget allows for a small amount of discretionary capital, but it is primarily those match-related items. It does include, you know, some ability to address deferred maintenance. It includes some ability to address discretionary items like that and school maintenance, but not necessarily at, you know, high amounts or in every year.
Your guesstimate percentage of that amount? Would it be 5% of the 150, 2%, 10, 15?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, so the baseline, you know, baseline core, you know, match only amount is in the 110 to 115 million range. And so the remaining amount here would go to, you know, some of those annual recurring projects that aren't necessarily match or are more discretionary in nature. But there is some, a very small amount. You know, this is, I would say, is a very constrained capital budget that we look at here. One thing, you know, proposals that were put forward this year that, you know, could be looked at in future years as well are, you know, if interest rates continue to be low, looking at concepts around general obligation bonds to meet some of those needs or use of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation bonding, which was a proposal put forward this year that would allow for, you know, some of that additional capital spending that may be of interest to policymakers.
Just a different question. We also talked upon, come back to me, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, when you think of it, you let us know. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're I'm noticing the assumption of 1.5% inflation throughout a good chunk of this, and I'm curious why you're saying 1.5 when, for example, Callan's coming back and telling a permanent foreign corporation that they're assuming 2 over the next few years. We've assumed it looks like inflation has been going up as the commissioner said, we're hoping it's transitory, but when we're seeing somebody like Callan come out and say that even before the jump in April, I'm wondering why we haven't assumed a higher rate of inflation.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, a part of that is really you know, the projection of a policy decision that it's our assumption future governors and legislatures will continue to place downward pressure on operating budgets. So because that is the current policy position of this administration, is continued constraint and downward pressure on the operating budget. And so when we put together the governor's 10-year plan, you know, we're reflecting that current policy of the executive branch to put constraint on operating budgets. And so including a full 2% would kind of imply that in those out years, there's no constraint, there's no downward pressure, that it's simply going to grow with inflation. And while that is a, you know, policy neutral way to project that future spending, which is why, you know, legislative finance uses that 2%, you know, we're not necessarily trying to produce a policy neutral document here. There's a lot of inherent policy in these numbers. And one of those policies really is that continued constraint on operating budgets, because we think that allowing them to grow unchecked isn't a good policy position for the state.
Senator Wilson, remember your question?
I did remember my question, but I had a follow-up to Senator Meyer's question on...
Let me stop you just for a second, because I'm looking at the time, and it's fine. I just want to make sure that we can stay in this room if our folks can stay with us, and we can go over time if people are agreeable, because that kind of looks like where we are right now, as far as, because I'm guessing there's going to be questions for Dr. Khattabi and our other speakers. So is everyone okay with going past? I'm guessing we could easily go till 4 o'clock or even beyond. So that's where we are. But this is important that we get our questions answered. So Senator Wilson, sorry to interrupt you.
Sorry. The lapse carry forward funds, what departments is the legislature doing a terrible job in catching the lapse carry forward funding to give us that type of assessment that was in the previous presentation? I mean, we chaired a subcommittee and we found $20 million that we cut out. And so I would like to know what other departments that we can look at. And according to, and then off of Senator Meyer's question, was certain departments, do you feel that we can cut more in certain departments? I mean, I would love to hear where we can cut more in your department, Department of Revenue. I have that subcommittee. I should have asked the commissioner that question. I just want to know where we can, these items are going to happen. I mean, DOT, we cut maintenance stations. We realized we had to reopen because of safety issues. We tried to cut the power off the Parks Highway, but we realized, again, safety concerns. So I'm just wondering, where do we try to cut budgets more and more in the downward pressure? My understanding is this is also a flat budget from the same administration who wants to have downward pressure. I have not seen that downward pressure in terms of, we tried that and it was sort of rejected because of a lot of just core safety issues. So I just want to know where we're doing a bad job in the lapse carry forward departments, because I would love to fix that for our next operating cycle. Or currently we're in the, you know, doing the cut sheets right now for the budget. So if you could let us know where we can, you know, without having additional supplemental budgets.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, so to address the, you know, lapsing funds, fiscal year 2020 was a particularly odd year when it comes to state spending. So we lapsed actually about $140 million of what would be really true lapse from agency operating budgets. But primarily, most of that was a result of normal state functions that ended up being funded with federal revenues. So a lot of that was enhanced FMAP, enhanced federal participation in the Medicaid program. That produced quite a bit of that $140 million. There are also some intentional choices to utilize some of the ability of the coronavirus relief fund to allow us to offset costs within public safety agencies. And so that allowed us to lapse money. Those decisions were made for a very specific reason, and that was to preserve money in the constitutional budget reserve, because throughout this entire time period, we've known that you know, the ability to retain money in the constitutional budget reserve, you know, buys us time to make some of these big policy decisions. So we made a conscious decision to utilize some of those CRF dollars to generate that lapse. Some of it, though, is more of the, you know, natural lapse of dollars of places where, you know, budgets may have been, you know, a little bit higher than they needed to be. And so one thing that we've done at OMB is start to compare when we go to agencies and talk to them about, you know, producing their next year's budget. We use a comparison to their actuals from the prior year, actual spending rather than budgeted spending. And because that gives us a better idea in that conversation of what really was spent, you know, if you didn't spend a dollar, you know, why didn't it get spent? You know, was it a result of, you know, some federal revenue that came in that, you know, provided you a windfall, or was it a result of that dollar not actually being needed in the first place? When you look at the budget proposal we put forward for fiscal year 22, you know, you see small pockets of where that happened. You know, agencies where you'll see vacant positions that haven't been filled for a long time coming off, commodities, cost reductions, small dollar value reductions that add up. And that kind of activity is going to just continue to be necessary year over year. But you're right to say that that won't necessarily get you $100 million in reductions each year. That kind of low-hanging fruit is gone. That's where a lot of these bigger policy questions and policy discussions are going to come in, and addressing some of those bigger cost drivers for the state. But, you know, again, those really involve, you know, pretty significant and robust conversations with constituents, with, you know, outside interests, and with the legislature. And so I guess to answer your, you know, kind of more pointed question, I can't give you a specific, here's the place to cut. You know, that's really, you know, the reductions that we put forward in the fiscal year 22 budget, we're identifying those places for fiscal year 23.
Just one last question.
Okay, Senator Wilson.
I guess my last question would be, in August, the administration is going to come with proposals for either reductions or revenues. Do you have an idea of what those might be and when we can get those, expected to have those? Because if we get them in August, we won't have enough time to sort of do that review of these policies. And is your expected date that we will have them ready by August?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, we'll be able to, you know, share that information as it's developed. But at this time, I don't have anything to share.
Thank you. Any further comments? Senator Greg Jackson, does she have the ability to unmute herself? Okay, so, and she was told she was welcome to chime in any time. So, Senator Greg Jackson, would you like to make any comment or ask a question? We'll just give you an opportunity, but you don't have to wait to be asked as we move forward.
Can you hear me?
Yes, speak up. Maybe.
Okay, excellent.
Can you take it off of speakerphone if you're using a speakerphone? Or get closer to the mic at your computer?
I'm not on speakerphone.
It's not working. You might want to call the teleconference line and we can bring you in that way. We can't understand you, so sorry. So if you call in, we'll take your comments and questions. Thank you, Senator Gray Jackson. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Steininger. We appreciate your coming before us. And now we're going to move on to Mohsin Ghatabi. Dr. Ghatabi has a two-part presentation. The first part is going to be focused on fiscal options and those impacts when you're looking at a fiscal plan. And then the second part will be how certainty plays into the strength of an economy. So, Dr. Ghatabi, welcome. Please put yourself on the record. Proceed.
Chair Hughes, thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Mohsin Ghatabi. I am an associate professor of economics at the Institute of Social and Economic Research. As Chair Hughes noted, I will be speaking about macro issues rather than responding directly to the proposal that we just heard about I'm going to go in the reverse order. I'm going to speak first about the effects of policy uncertainty. We all know that we've been dealing with uncertainty for multiple years. And a few years ago, what I wanted to do was try to quantify these effects of uncertainty. And so I apologize. I did not number my slides, and I don't know if you have them in front of you. But on the third slide, I just want to say something quickly before jumping in. That the conversation thus far is interesting, and the reason I'm not talking specifically about the merits of the 50-50 proposal is, A, I was not privy to the details up until a couple of days ago, and the second thing, as was noted, is there are quite a few assumptions about price, about production, about market returns, and then on the spending side, if there are cuts, which of those cuts potentially get implemented, and if there are increases in revenue, which revenue measures are actually implemented. That means modeling any sort of macroeconomic consequences incredibly challenging. And again, I was not aware of the details. And so I'm just going to move on to the fourth slide. And it's really, the reason I'm sharing with you this background is I think it's interesting that the conversation has evolved quite a bit over the last few years. In 2015, 2016, there was this impression that waiting to solve the fiscal crisis was not costly because we had ample savings. And I was getting concerned as to that narrative. And so I went and I looked at the economic literature and what it potentially had to say about the cost of uncertainty. And I found really robust work that tried to identify, are private firms responsive to high uncertainty at the policy level? And as we all know, during the financial crisis, there was an immense amount of uncertainty. And so authors looked at the number of times, for example, that words like uncertainty were mentioned in the media. And what they tried to do is basically look to see if mentions of uncertainty in the media were causally influencing investment decisions at the private level. And they found very, very robust findings. That last bullet point on the fourth slide shows you that they find that economic policy uncertainty can explain up to 32% of the drop in corporate investment between 07 and 09. And again, this does not apply directly to Alaska, but it does tell us that private investments and private decisions by households are not immune to uncertainty at the federal level or at the state level. And we all know that mentions of uncertainty or budget stability are mentioned on a regular basis in our newspapers. So on slide five, I show you an alternative example, if that one is not convincing. And the first paper does something really interesting. They look at whether or not states borrow at a higher rate around gubernatorial elections because there is uncertainty around who's going to win, and if so, what are his or her policies going to be? And they find that borrowing rates jump around that time. And we all know that the type of uncertainty we've been dealing with is much higher than simply elections, because we don't know if a tax is going to be implemented. We don't know if a government cut is going to be implemented, and if so, which one. We don't know what's going to happen to the dividend. And the last example is one where basically, again, same thing, looking at an election and actually measuring what happens to investment, corporate investment. And that last paper is incredibly convincing and really well done, and it's done at the state level, which makes it the most similar to how we think about uncertainty. And they find that investment drops by between 5% and 15% as a result of uncertainty around elections. So my little back of the envelope exercise to bring this, sorry.
I gotta leave my mom at 10:30. No later than 10:30. So if they can make it in 10:30, that would be great. I will get that address right now.
Okay.
Senator Greg Jackson, I think you may need to. There, we're good. Sorry about that. Continue.
Okay. So that last bullet point, that Jen's 2013, is a really convincing analysis showing, again, this is private investment responding to the uncertainty, and they find that it drops by between 5 and 15% in the quarters around the election. So what I did is I said, can we use this information to potentially think about how much Alaska has missed out on? And is there a way that we can use these estimates to potentially wrap our heads around the cost of uncertainty, if you will? Again, this is back of the envelope, but to me, it helped me think about it, and you'll have to decide whether you find the exercise convincing or not. So on slide six, I show you construction spending. ICER used to do construction spending forecasts, and we have data on spending by private industry, by the public sector, and how much construction spending happens in state. And you see the numbers before you right there. And so what I do is I focus on that red or maroon bar. I don't know which color you see it as on your screens, but in 2019, private construction spending was about $4.4 billion. And I asked myself, assume we apply that 5 to 15% reduction to that $4.4 billion, how much more spending potentially would have been in state had there been no uncertainty? Had we resolved questions around taxes and the PFD and spending cuts? And so on slide seven, I basically just show you, again, this is back of the envelope, but if we are to apply that 5 to 15% private construction spending, we would find that essentially we missed out, if you will, on somewhere between $220 to $660 million, because these are potentially dollars that would have been invested in the state, and those are just direct dollars. Now, of course, there is no evidence that there were people waiting in the wings, but we've all heard anecdotes about plans being canceled, about loans not being given out because of uncertainty. And that's just one simple example that, to me, whenever I went through the exercise and I released a report in 2018 that's available on the ICER website, where I go through this exercise, it again shows that waiting is not a costless option. And because, again, the narrative at the time was ample savings, therefore the short-term options like a tax, like a government cut, will take money out of the economy, but waiting is good because it potentially protects economic activity. I guess this is the counterpoint, which says that if waiting is inserting uncertainty into the decision-making by private industry or by private households for that matter, meaning think about the out-migration we've been experiencing, think about the fact that the Department of Labor has said that we're losing people, not so much because people are leaving, but because there are fewer people moving into Alaska. How much of the uncertainty has dissuaded people potentially from coming into the state? So I'm just going to pause for a second because that's really all I wanted to say about uncertainty. If there are questions or comments, I'm happy to take them before pivoting. I know you're short on time, and so I want to be respectful of that.
Dr. Katabi, I'd just like to know that missed opportunity between $220 and $660 million private capital spending, that was construction, not including construction related to the oil industry. Is that correct, that you had a separate?
Chair, use that. That's using overall private spending, and therefore it's inclusive of petroleum spending. In the previous slide, I broke it down by petroleum, which is a subset of private construction.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that clarification. Thank you. Okay. Senator Myers.
Professor, my question is, do we think that this might be cumulative, or are we looking at losing roughly the same amount each year, or is it getting worse year by year?
through the chair, Senator Myers, I actually think about this as additive, meaning that these are year effects. This is how much we're potentially missing out on every year as the crisis, if we want to call it that, endures. And to your point, I obviously don't have evidence of this, but of course it could potentially be getting worse because there are reputational issues, there are credit rating issues, and we've all heard about those. And so this is using an estimate that was showing declines in spending in quarters after elections or around elections. So I really think about these as yearly effects because I am using construction spending for a particular year. So this is an example of how many losses would occur in a given year. So you're correct that if we want to play this out and say uncertainty started in 2016, and we need to actually multiply this by 4 years or actually see that, conclude that the losses are actually getting bigger. So, but my point here is not to take the 220 or 660 to the bank. It's an it's a way to illustrate that private decisions are negatively influenced by waiting, and there is ample, very good causal evidence of that. And if we use Alaska-specific numbers, the losses are actually similar to some of the losses we estimate that come from implementing a tax or from some cut. And so really the takeaway for me is that it's really important that the cost of waiting become part of the conversation.
Thank you. I would agree with you too. So we'll go on to the next slide.
So on slide 8, I just pivot. And so I'm going to move to slide 9. And this is, some of you may be familiar with the work that we released 5 years ago now, 6 years ago. And so what I am going to do for the rest of the presentation, and I'm happy to answer specific questions, but kind of roll through this fairly quickly, summarize for you what we learned 5 years ago when we were asked to essentially, we being colleagues, Matt Berman, Gunnar Knapp, and myself, we were asked to essentially assess the short-term economic effects from a few of the fiscal options that were being debated at the time. And so we really modeled generic options. And I'm emphasizing the generic part because, as we heard in the previous presentations, unless you have the details of a proposal, it becomes really hard to speak about where is a cut going to come from. If you structure a tax, how is it going to look? Who is it going to affect? And so what I'm going to present to you, so this is the best way to think about what I'm going to present to you is, for every $100 million that we raise through one of the fiscal options that I will present, what are the potential economic losses associated with that $100 million? Why might there be economic losses? Because in most of the revenue options, you're basically taking money from either households or from businesses or from people that would have spent it. The other point I need to make before moving on is that these are short-term losses, meaning that the results from this study should not guide long-term decisions about quality of life or amenities or what's the adequate level of spending for Medicaid or any other program. This is basically saying, I take $100 million as a result of a sales tax. How much less money is circulating in the economy as a result of that? And how many jobs and how much less income is there? Excuse me. The last point is important. These are results from 2016, and I'm purposely not updating them because I want to be transparent about what we did then. But clearly, you know this better than I, that the state's fiscal situation is very different. We've already exhausted most of the savings, and the state's economic picture has changed quite a bit, meaning we were at the very beginning of the recession 5 years ago, we've essentially been in a multi-year recession. We have 2019, where we grew at a fairly modest rate, but then we've fallen back into a recession as a result of COVID. So I am providing caveats because I think it's important context, but it's also important to acknowledge the many, many limitations that exist in thinking about this exercise. So the slide 10 is basically just kind of summarizing everything that I've said, which is anything that we do is going to take money from some group of people. Deciding which group of people do we want to raise money from has implications. There are questions about what's progressive, what's regressive, which of the options affect which communities, how do taxes interact with existing taxes, how do cuts affect individuals and communities. And then the question about the permanent fund, which you were discussing in the previous presentations, is important because overdraws clearly have consequences in terms of the fund's ability to grow and to continue paying PFDs and government services. So if it's okay, I'm going to skip a couple of slides. Unless there are questions about the details, I'm going to go to the actual results unless I'm told otherwise.
Continue.
So I'm going to go to slide 14, which is the first graph that shows you the job impacts. And so the job impacts list out those 11 options, and then they tell you how many jobs would be lost in the short run if we were to raise $100 million from each of those options. Now, a couple of points that are worth noting is you see at the very top, there is cutting state workforce. Some of you may be scratching your head and saying, why are those numbers so big? It's because unlike reducing income from individuals, if you were to lay off individuals, you lose the initial government job and then you lose the spending associated with that individual. And then when you talk about a tax, clearly people are keeping their jobs, but they have now less money. They're spending less in the economy, and that's how you're getting those job losses. We estimate two different versions of the model depending on how people spend money. That's how you get a low and high scenario. And clearly, amongst the revenue options, there are some differences. Why might there be differences? Those differences depend on, again, are you taxing high-income people? Are you taxing low-income people? Lower-income individuals tend to spend more of their money in more of their disposable income, and therefore they influence economic activity more. If you were to reduce the PFD, you see more losses. Why? Because the vast majority of Alaskans get the PFD. So the main differences in terms of short-term effects come from how many potential non-residents are affected by the tax? Are you targeting the tax in a progressive or regressive manner? And that's how you get the variation. I want to close this slide by saying this does not say anything about which option is best or which option is worst. It simply tells you, if you were to magically remove money by imposing an income tax, these are potentially the short-term effects. And I failed to define short-term, but we typically define short-term as within a year before people and businesses start changing their habits. So the next slide basically says, rather than looking at jobs, let's look at income. And when you look at income, again, what stands out is the consequences from the dividend cut, because again, the dividend cut falls on Alaskans largely. And you can see again that there is variation in the income losses that are largely driven by the progressive or regressive nature of the tax and by how much our non-residents, if you will, participating in quote unquote paying for the tax. To be perfectly transparent, getting those numbers well or modeling them well is incredibly difficult because, as we know, there is considerable variation by industry in terms of non-residency, and there is considerable variation across the state in the participation of non-residents. And so that's how you get some of this variation. But I think it's an informative exercise about short-term effects of the fiscal options. It tells you less about what should you do 5 years, 10 years from now, and what's more prudent and what gives you the best quality of life. And so that those are the limitations essentially of that work. And so you think a lot about regional effects. And so on slide 16, I just acknowledge the fact that we don't know, we don't do an analysis at the regional level. But of course, as I say in every talk that I give, we do not have an Alaskan economy. We have many economies within the state. And so every single one of these options, whether it would be a government cut or it would be a tax or it would be a PFD cut, are going to interact or intersect with what the community has, what it doesn't have, what are its resources, how dependent is it on goods and services that are provided. And so, again, those long-term ramifications are very, very different from the things that we do in our exercise. And very quickly, I spent the last 5 years studying empirically the socioeconomic effects of the PFD. And so if time allows, I can tell you very quickly of what we've learned in terms of the economic effects of the PFD. We've looked at its effect on employment. We've looked at its effects on childhood obesity. We looked at its effects on spending as well. And so I can just summarize them for you quickly if time allows.
I think we would like to hear that if you can be sure to do that.
Yeah, I will go through them quickly. And my colleague Matt Berman has a really interesting paper where he looks at the effect of the PFD on poverty. He finds that there's been substantial reductions in poverty as a result of the PFD, and he finds that the effects are substantial for the elderly. So again, when thinking about how the PFD interacts with well-being, it's important to think about it regionally, but it's also important to think about welfare. And Matt's work, Matt's paper, which is really interesting, kind of delves into the question of how much higher would poverty have been in the absence of the PFD, and I encourage all of you to look at it. On slide 19, some of my own work with my colleagues, Brett Watson and Matt Reimer, looks at the effect of the PFD on childhood obesity. And we find that receiving an additional PFD, because we know that there is a timing question in terms of a child that's born before December receives that year's PFD, one that's born in January does not. We exploit that, and we find that having that additional $1,000 is immensely helpful in terms of maintaining an adequate weight. On slide 20, we studied twice in the paper that I showed you earlier, Gunnar Knapp, Matt Berman, and myself find that for every $100 million increase in the size of PFD, there are about 725 jobs that are created in the short run. In a separate exercise where we actually exploit variation in employment, we find that around the distribution of the PFD, for every $100 million, there are about 475 short-term jobs that are created. And then we find that women tend to work a few hours less around the distribution time. And so those are employment facts that do tell us that we know that there is at least some spending of the PFD that happens in state, because otherwise we would not be finding these short-term fluctuations in employment. And then lastly, this is not our work, but I've summarized all the empirical work from PFD. There's this really interesting paper by Kuang that looks at what happens to spending patterns in Alaska relative to spending patterns in Washington. And he finds that around the distribution of the PFD, there is about, for every dollar in the PFD, about 22 to 24 cents of that dollar gets spent in the 3 months post-distribution. So again, evidence that our spending patterns in state are different than the ones that are observed in other states where there is no such distribution. And he uses very, very granular spending data. So I apologize for being long-winded. I'm going to stop. And if there is something that I've said that you would like to follow up on, please feel free to reach out.
Actually, I thought you did very well moving along quickly, so we appreciate that. So, members, you have questions, and I did get a note that Senator Gabe Jackson is in good shape, and, of course, she can ask a question if she has one. At this time, I don't have any questions here from members, and do you have any closing thoughts that you would like to say? I know you're not weighing in on the policy, but I thought your presentation about the certainty factor is interesting in that next year will be an election year, and if we haven't solved this, then we have economic policy that's not settled. So we might get a bit of a double whammy. So I think it's good for us to be aware of that, that there is a cost to delaying. So I appreciate that. That's an important part of this conversation. Any closing thoughts, Dr. Gatabi?
Chair Hughes, I agree that uncertainty certainly belongs in the conversation. And again, on the point about weighing in, I think that considerations about price, production, returns of the fund, and if cuts where and if taxes where are incredibly important. And so I look forward to looking more carefully at the proposal and to potentially developing a better understanding of its consequences in the short run and the long run. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak.
Well, thank you very much. And if you do look at it with the details in the proposal, we'd love to hear from you again on that. And we're going to pivot now to our last pair of speakers, and actually the mention of every $100 million creating approximately 475 jobs, I think is going to be a bit related to our final two presenters. So we have Christy Bell. You are up first. You are on screen. Let's do a sound check. Are you able to hear me?
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Yes, you're coming in nice and clear. So we have your first slide is on the screen.
And I'm going to do something similar as what Dr. Gatabi just did. I will not follow my presentation as much as try and just rapidly go through so that hopefully everyone can catch up on time quicker. So for the record, my name is Christy Bell. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and I lead the Business Enterprise Institute. Our mission there is to diversify the economy of Alaska and to better position the university in engaging with both businesses and communities. Programs like the Small Business Development Center, Center for Economic Development, Manufacturing Extension Partnership, Procurement Technical Assistance Center, and the Cooperative Development Center all roll up through the Business Enterprise Institute. And so collectively, we serve around 2,500 individual businesses, small businesses, as well as micro enterprises. I'll touch on those later, each year. And so I'm going to take things down a level. I was asked to speak to how consistently reliable PFD will add to some certainty as it relates to the behavior of small businesses. And we'll bounce through just some quick points to help give you a few things to think about. So as Nusim just said, while we can point to jobs per the PFD, they are part-time and temporary. They tend to be over that first quarter, and I'm paraphrasing ICER work, and so Dr. Katabi can make certain to correct me if I'm wrong. The PFD contributes to local business spending, so businesses definitely benefit. Grocery stores, restaurants, retail chains, even entities like Alaska Airlines. And our buying patterns, though, don't really change. We may just be spending here and there a little bit differently, perhaps making an early trip or planning towards a vacation. Each and every one of us spends uniquely and differently. And then as it relates to our recent COVID stimulus impacts, and this is something that our group considered as we were considering this testimony, what we've seen is consumer spending has increased in some places. That's helped boost labor expenditures as both the PFD and federal payments have come in. And again, this is all anecdotal information. I can't speak to, this is just what we're seeing with our client base. Savings rates have been boosted. This is per national data between from a 13.9% to 30% in some cases. And that's because folks are feeling the risk of the pandemic, the risk of a tight economic situation, and are choosing to save more readily. They're also paying off debt, credit cards, paying off any past rent and overdue mortgage as stimulus payments have come in. So the anecdotal information points to that as new dollars come in, individuals may pay down debt. It may go towards business investment, and it may go towards savings, and all of this is really individual specific. It's all based on risk tolerance. It's also all based on an individual's vision for what they think that they might be able to do with an influx of some capital. Quickly, I think it's important for this group when we talk about small businesses to consider different definitions. I'm sorry, did you want me to stop?
No, go ahead. We have your small business definition slide up.
Great. And so most people, when we say small businesses, they think of that little kiosk down the street. The reality is, according to the U.S. Small Business Administration, all small businesses are those that employ less than 500 or have annual receipts under $7.5 million. This does vary by industry sector, and so that's a very generic and all-encompassing definition. But I think that should all of a sudden open your eyes that small businesses are pretty significant as it relates to employment. And then when we think about microenterprise, while we don't have, or at least I have not been able to find a specific definition according to how the state of Alaska defines microenterprises. Programs across the state that really focus here, like the Alaska Community Land Trust, they focus on those enterprises that will have less than five employees and have a capital need of less than $35,000. And then we also need to consider solo entrepreneurs. Those are those individuals that are have running their own operation, consultants to taxi drivers. So let's look at those as it relates to Alaska businesses and the stats to Alaska. That's my next slide. We have a total number of businesses in Alaska, just under 75,000. Of those, we have nearly 5,000 that are considered small business firms. And those, again, are those with less than 500 employees. Then we have nearly, 16,500, 500,000 that are micro enterprises. Those have at least one employee and sometimes up to 10 employees. And then we have those solo enterprises in Alaska that constitutes almost 52,000 individual proprietors. They don't have employees, and they tend to be, as I said, consultants, maybe a real estate agent that is, operating their own enterprise, a handyman, a housekeeper. And so it can't even be employed individuals that have a side gig. And less than 1% of these are early stage entrepreneurs. I'm going to bounce quickly to the next slide. And the Small Business Administration reviewed which states have the most small businesses. And that, again, according to the Small Business Administration, are those businesses with less than 500 employees. And so nationally, there's 99.9% of all businesses across the U.S. are small businesses. It represents approximately 47.3% of our workforce. And many of those businesses employ less than 100. So I think that helps you as a committee think about what small businesses are and how we define them across the U.S. Alaska is known for having one of the highest rates of entrepreneurship. So of that nearly 75,000 small businesses, 99.1% is are within that realm. The small business rate, and this I was specifically asked, per capita were approximately 11 within the U.S. So considering all states, when we stack them up, we're number 11. And when it comes to total employment, we're number 12. So this really speaks to how we as Alaskans are entrepreneurial, how we are a very business-friendly state. And that's typically because we don't have sales or income tax.
Senator Myers.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So question for you is just looking at the statistics, if we're 11th highest among states with our small business rate, but we're 50th highest among states with our small business employees, my initial thought with that is that that means that we probably have the among the highest rates of the solo entrepreneurs that you were mentioning. Is that correct?
That is very much correct. And that's, when we consider nearly 75,000 total businesses, the solo enterprises make up nearly 52,000 of those. And so that's, I think, a critical point for this committee to consider. And I'll speak to that a little bit more. Did that answer your full question, Senator Myers?
And while we're talking about those solo, I don't know whether Christy will mention this or not, because she's not taking a position on the policy concept, the proposal. But one of the things when you think about those solo entrepreneurs and business owners, many have families. And let's just take a typical family where a business owner has a spouse and two children. And then you talk about it, for instance, the 50-50 POMV split PFD. This year would be, we'll round it up to 2,400. So you, in a family, a business owner might have close to 10,000 coming in a year. And so that is part of the fascinating thing. And I don't know if you're going to be able to comment on the Gabe Lehman with Cook Inlet Housing was managing during the pandemic increments of about $10,000 for small business owners, many low and middle income business owners, many of those solo, and the kind of things that they were able to do with $10,000. So that's kind of where we're going here when we have a lot of solo business owners and what that kind of a certainty with an amount of roughly $10,000 for a family might be, and how, they they will be making decisions. And one thing I didn't ask Dr. Ghatabi while he was online, he says there is research out there. He hasn't done it, but people make tend to make more prudent decisions when they have a larger sum of money than a smaller sum. So a 500, you know, a family, if your dividend were $500, family four, that's 2,000. Yes, they might buy that big screen TV, but if it's 10,000, you know, they might decide that they're going to invest it some way. So it does make, there is research out there on that matter. And so we're just going to talk about knowing the during the pandemic when these amounts of 10,000 were available, what kind of things might happen. So I'll let you continue, Christy, but I just, that's how the basis and why we invited Christy and Tim, who's next, to speak about what they've seen as far as the smaller amounts and how it can impact small business.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. I agree wholeheartedly with where you're heading, and my next slide speaks to some of that. Was there another question?
No, go ahead.
Thank you. So the next slide, the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development did some research, and it's titled The State of Entrepreneurship. I'm happy to get that to you, Senator Hughes. And it really looked at startups and then the private sector job growth. And with the startups, so that's a small sector, they usually have an average number of employees of 4.8. And these firms represent, you know, if we look out 5 years, around 89% of the job growth still. So some of them end up closing, but still those that are continuing to scale. But really, the other piece that I think is critical as it relates to this slide is the sources of capital. These businesses, even, you know, I can say I've worked with businesses of all scale. The majority, as they're launching, look at their personal finances and their family's savings. They then will look to commercial loans or their personal credit cards. They'll look at other family assets. Is it possible for me to take a second out on my home? Is there anything around my home that I don't need anymore and might be able to sell? And then they go to their family and friends and ask. And so what you were just speaking to really speaks to how individuals with a vision of scaling most sizes of business really don't need large tranches of capital. So the following slide, if we look at just the number of firms that need less than 25,000, that's 35% of all firms. And then if we look at the other end of the spectrum, those firms that require 250,000 to up to 3 million, that's around 10% of the firms. I can tell you the firms that are receiving those larger tranches of money have already proven themselves out and probably have done the first stage of their business with this less than 25,000 or 25 to 50,000 is what we typically see. And so while I wasn't able to chat with Gabe Laban, I can tell you that even in our own organization, firms don't need a ton of money. I think we all think about, oh my gosh, this entrepreneur, he had millions of dollars and that's how he was able to launch his little store. It's not always the case. It's oftentimes a story of bootstrapping and hard work. I've chatted with an individual who used their PFD to buy some construction equipment and just slowly, incrementally built it up over a number of decades. And so that's what we see. So some closing thoughts.
Yeah, Chris.
Go ahead.
Oh, Senator Gray Jackson, I noticed you've unmuted. Did you have a comment or question? Or?
Can you hear me?
Not very well. You can try again.
Actually, I think there's something going on here, but I'm fine.
She's not fine.
We're okay. Sounds like you're fine, but when we were still having trouble hearing you through that. So we're back to you, Christy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So some closing thoughts. It's nearly impossible for me to predict the behavior of individuals. I can assume with some consistency and certainty, we may see more solo businesses, micro enterprises, and even small businesses that are able to predict, all right, I'm going to have, I'm going to go with your assumption, Madam Chair, I'm going to have approximately $10,000, and I can use that to either leverage other capital, because commercial lenders want to see some skin in the game. Even angel investors want to see some skin in the game. And so when we consider 23% of entrepreneurs require less than $10,000 and 12% more require less than $25,000, we can see how, you know, a significant number of the entrepreneurs in our state can potentially be benefited with some certainty, or at least they can plan their business launch or any additional business investments. And then all of you know, entrepreneurial activity is correlated to increased economic growth. And I just told you startup firms are creating a significant number of our future jobs. And so I think I've partially touched on it all, except for to really know, we would have to interview, we would have to survey, we would have to really dig in on some deeper research.
Well, we appreciate bringing that. You were very responsive with a limited amount of time, and we appreciate that. So it's just something I think it's a takeaway for me, Dr. Katabi, was there's a cost to uncertainty. And a takeaway from this is we probably very much will see some growth in small business activity, which will strengthen our economy. So those are just important things to consider as we look at what's before us. So thank you very much, Christy. And I'm not seeing any questions from members. So now we will go to our final presenter, Tim Dillon with the Kenai Peninsula Economic Development District. So we're bringing you up. You're on our screen. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and go over your thoughts for us, please.
Thank you so much. I appreciate having the opportunity, Senator Hughes. My name is Tim Dillon. I'm the executive director for the Kenai Peninsula Economic Development District. Next slide. We are a private non-government resource focused on responsible and sustainable economic development for our region. We have a very small staff. There's a total of four of us. We work very closely with the other three federal economic development districts, and we're one of the nine statewide ARDRs. The Kenai Peninsula is one of the most diverse economies in the state, but our quality of living is the major overarching concern. Individuals, couples, families, all of them attempt to plan. But their plan is got to be based on a bigger picture. So businesses and families really cannot financially prepare for the future without a statewide fiscal plan. It's very, very important. What does a statewide fiscal plan provide? People can go ahead and plan to be able to make down payments and deposits, whether you're an individual or a business. Collateral for new and emerging businesses, financial stability, increased private investment, help to retain and reopen businesses. All of these are part of the idea of having a state fiscal plan. Recently, Senator Michiki was quoted as saying, you know, we need to come together as Alaskans, because until we solve the fiscal plan, beginning with the permanent fund, dividend solution, we are stuck in neutral. I got to tell you, truer words have never been spoken. I also have to tell you, since the agenda yesterday was formalized and online, I have heard from countless individuals that are concerned about the budget and the permanent fund dividend. Next slide. And they wanted to remind me about the PFD. Unfortunately, our legislators, you folks sitting around the table, have done your best, but because you're focusing on the permanent fund and we haven't been able to come up with a solution for that fiscal plan, as you mentioned earlier, Senator Hughes, we haven't been able to deal as much with fighting against crime, improvements in workforce, bettering Alaska's education system, and community infrastructure. A fiscal plan is so needed for our communities to be able to plan. If you look at the information on the left side, recently with the help of the Alaska small business folks, we went ahead and looked at, from a statewide perspective, if someone had additional dollars, whether it be a business or an individual, what would you use it for? And you'll see the top five things there. And it's exactly what Christy just said and Matavi had said, you know, replacing lost revenue, paying people, paying your bills, rent and mortgage, infrastructure and investments. Those are the things that people need their money for. If you look on the right side, this is another interesting data point that plays right back into what Christy was talking about. During the last year, we actually did a survey taking a look at things on the Kenai Peninsula, and we found something that we didn't know. 73% of all of our businesses on the Kenai Peninsula have five or less employees. That's huge to know that, but it plays right into all the other data that we're looking at. So recently, the Arters, several of us, met with some statewide financial institutions regarding funding sources for businesses, microloans, and conducted a variety of different surveys. KPED, we have one microloan program already, and we're working on a second one. But the key takeaway was that because interest rates are at all-time lows, the businesses really need help with down payments and collateral, which again is something that we've been hearing. It's the same message. So although no one can guarantee what people will do with their PFD, there is absolutely no doubt that it will be an improvement for all Alaskans and their quality of living. A lot of businesses will see a revenue boost from the PFD as Alaskans use it to increase, whether it be food security, preparing for the winter, and paying utilities. On a call yesterday that I had with several Arter directors, I was amazed to hear the number of folks in their communities from around the state that, as a family, they go ahead and they pool their money to be able from their PFDs in order to be able to prepay fuel for the oncoming winter, along with other things like winterizing their cars and doing the other necessary things they have to do to make sure they could get through the winter. Yesterday, I'm sure you probably saw on the news that Alaskans were out in force wanting to support their neighbors. One of the things they need is money to do that. But these are pictures from yesterday at 12 o'clock over in the Soldotna Creek Park. It was Soldotna's first Wednesday market in a long, long time. They had 47 vendors and small businesses there. During the day, they had 35 people attend, and at the evening, they had 2,000 plus people stick around for the con. Again, Alaskans wanting to support Alaskans, but in order for them to do that, they have to know that they've got money in their pockets, and they have to be able to plan. And just remember, last month, we had the same thing down in Homer, the King Salmon Tournament. You had a record high, 1,562 anglers from around the state, 545 boats, and $238,000 in prize money. Let's make sure Alaskans can afford to support Alaskans. I began this presentation talking about the Arters. Please remember, we are a resource. We're the ones with boots on the ground. We're the ones that people are knocking on our door and coming sitting on our couch, and we're trying to help them make sure that they can make it from one day to the next, whether it be a big operation or a mom-and-pop operation. Every region in the state has someone that's assisting them from one of the arters. Also remember, we're the ones that handle the outreach and the technical assistance for the Alaska Cares and a variety of other programs. So please, this is great today, but continue to involve us on the front end. Instead of us having to jump in at the end, as most of you remember, at the end of last summer, we're actually the ones that figured out the four problems with how the RPL was written in order to be able to make sure that the monies could hit the street in the proper way. So please, involve us. Let us help you with making sure there's acceptable implementation. So what it's going to take is working together to create a sustainable and responsible statewide plan for all Alaskans. In closing, though, I want to remind us, there are 677 businesses statewide that did everything they were supposed to do for the Alaska Cares program. Unfortunately, the money ran out and they received $0. On behalf of all the arters, we ask you to please make sure, as people are planning, that those individual businesses, 677 of them, it's approximately $30 million, $32 million, please make sure they're taken care of. Thank you for allowing me to present, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Tim. Are there any questions from members? And seeing that there aren't, thank you very much today. It's been an insightful presentation, and we appreciate closing out with what's hearing in one of our communities in our state. We wish we would have had time to hear from all the regions. It's just time is too short, so we appreciate that snapshot as far as what's happening on the Kenai and the impact of small business and how it works. And I would ask Christy and Tim and, you know, those that you work with, as you're able to come up with examples, particularly I understand that there were increments in the neighborhood of $10,000 actually that were through the Alaska Community Land Trust and the Cook Inlet Housing that were used to help in some of those areas of Anchorage, maybe where they're might have been extra struggles for small business owners, the Mountain View area, the Fairview area, and the difference that made. So if in your area in the Kenai, Christy, as you have statewide contacts, if you come across any of those testimonies from business owners and what they were able to achieve with those smaller increments, that would be really helpful for us to have as information as we make these decisions before us. So with that, I'm not seeing any other comments or questions from committee members, and we have no other business before us at this time, and so we will now adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:03 p.m.